Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and you're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. Well, today our guest is a brilliant writer that I have really resonated with his writing for years. He writes for Empire Burlesque, and his name is Chris Floyd. Chris Floyd, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Well, thanks, Cindy. I'm really glad to be here. I just wanted to say it's a real honor for me to be able to talk to you because you've been one of the one of my heroes and one of the few heroes that I think we've had in American politics in the last decade. So I'm really glad to talk to you.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And I'm going to be asking you about current events. And just, you know, be assured that almost everything that I think you're going to say is something that I would say, too. It seems like we're practically twins in ideology, and I always like to have people on that I agree with because it seems like the other side, the war side, the oppression side, gets all the time in the media, so I only bring on people that I think like are on the right side of the issues.
Well, you can. There's certainly no shortage of the other viewpoint. That's for sure.
Yeah. So, well, there's one thing that's on most of the news these days, and that's the Occupy movement. And last night, which since this is recorded, it'll play on Sunday, but last night was Tuesday, October 25th. And here in Oakland, California, there was another police riot when the Occupy Oakland people actually stood up for their First Amendment rights here in the United States. And I just want you to give us some thoughts, your thoughts in general about the Occupy movement and the increasing oppression that it's receiving from the police state here in the United States.
Well, yeah, that's good. You know, I'm speaking from England, so I'm a little bit behind the news over in America, but I just saw the headlines a little while ago about what was going on in Oakland. sorry about that. Well, I mean, I feel like the Occupy movement has been one of the few sort of bright spots that we've seen in a long time. And I felt like, I thought about it earlier, even before we were going to this interview, that it was, in some ways, it kind of grows out of what. Not in a direct way, but it was the sort of thing that you were doing when you were going and occupying the road outside of Bush's ranch and things like this.
Right.
It's ordinary people standing up and making and finding an alternative to all these institutions that have failed us. You know, as you know, back in the Bush years, where could you go to confront Bush with these kind of questions? The media wouldn't ask them to them. You know, the Democrats wouldn't confront him. It took individual citizens to stand up there and just make their presence known. Outside all these failed avenues of reply and response. And I think that's what we're seeing in the Occupy movement. And, of course, it's inevitable that it's going to provoke a stronger and stronger response the stronger it grows. And it's not surprising that it's happening out in Oakland, which I know has a pretty poor record in that police rioting, as you put it. You know, it's not a friendly sort of town in that regard. So, and over here in England, it's spreading a little bit. It's down in London. They're outside St. Paul's Cathedral right now, is where they're the main occupation down there. And they haven't moved against it with the police presence much, but what we see over here is the same thing you've been seeing over there in America. Is the right now what they're doing over here is trying to belittle it. They find ways to make fun of it. And yesterday they went around with these thermal cameras trying to prove that some of the tents were empty, as if that had something to do with anything. But, you know, and so instead of dealing with the issue, they deal with all these side issues, and, oh, aren't these people scruffy, and, oh, I saw some of them going to Starbucks to get coffee, as if they're not supposed to drink coffee, you know, because they're a
person. Right.
So that's what's going on over there. But I wrote about it a couple of weeks ago or last week, is that, you know, who knows what will come of it, and to me, this sort of thing is a very long game. You know, it's a long game. It's not going to. You see a lot of people. You see some so-called progressives and something. They will say, "Oh, well, it hasn't changed everything, or it's not going to change everything overnight." Well, it might not change things for years. It might not change things for generations. But you have to take these steps, and you have to have these these movements, these eruptions of something out of the, you know, out of the public consciousness, to move things forward in any kind of, or at least hope to move things forward. So, I mean, I'm heartened by it in a lot of ways. I mean, I don't. I was writing about it the other day on my blogging. I'm a little bit old, you know. I mean, it's not just a movement for youth, of course not. But I mean, it's being led by youth, and I think that's good. I think it's good. And in saying that, I see a lot of so-called progressives and people and bloggers and stuff. You know, they come down with some sage advice for the Occupy. Well, you should do this. You should do that. No, you should put together a program. You know, you should, I don't know what, get some TV time or something. It's like, well, just let's let these people, let the people who actually had the courage, as you did years ago and do now, had the courage to stand up, step out, and, you know, let them figure out how they want to do it. And so, I'm very pleased with it, actually, and I don't know what will come of it, but I don't see how you could not be pleased if you feel, as I know you feel, and so many people feel, that all the avenues of as I said, of response and, you know, resistance and any sort of institutional way that you could address some of these questions, the war state, the security state, the class war that's being waged against the 99%, you know, all of our institutional responses have failed. You know, the universities have failed. The politics, the political parties have failed. The media has failed most egregiously. And so and there's nothing really left but for people to take in their own hands. And what I like about the Occupy is that they don't have a program. What they're doing is the program. You know, they're offering an alternative. And so this is I'm encouraged.
Well, and then we see here in the United States that, and I think to a lesser degree in Europe, because I've done a lot of work with activists, you know, anti-capitalist activists and anti-war activists in Europe also, is that when there becomes an effective social movement, whether it's, you know, the anti-war movement, when you know, it really took off in 2005, or now this movement, the Occupy movement, is that, or even the Tea Party movement in the United States on the right, you know, the Tea Party movement was co-opted by the Republican Party, and they turned it into a neocon movement. And we see, on one hand, Democrats like Nancy Pelosi, the former Speaker of the House and the House Minority Leader right now, and Barack Obama, you know, expressing solidarity with, and not just solidarity, but they say they understand what the Occupy movement is doing, which of course they don't. But we see them co-opting it for political gains on one hand, but yesterday in Oakland and recently in Chicago, two towns that have mayors who are in the Democratic Party, Rahm Emanuel in Chicago and Jean Kwan in Oakland, you know, very, very violently suppressed and oppressed the movements and arrested hundreds of people arrested. And yet we have this, you know, this myth in the United States that there's some kind of difference between the Democratic and Republican Party. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, of course. I mean, I think in some ways the only difference is that the Democrats can get away with even more than Republicans can in the terms of oppression and return of, as you see in Obama, because when Obama came in, as you know, all organized opposition to the war machine just disappeared, because now a Democrat was running it. You know, where are the Democrats who were thundering against Bush's drones? Where are the Democrats who were thundering against Bush's, you know, death squads and his indefinite detention? Well, they all disappeared. And the same thing, of course, is happening with these Democratic mayors. I mean, Rahm Emanuel, these kind of people, you can't be more harder edged than most of these Democrats are. I mean, a Republican would be, you know, there is no difference. That's what the Occupy thing is about, I think. And I'm not too worried about the Occupy movement itself being co-opted. I mean, people are going to co-opt the brand name, and that's the American way. Of course, they're going to do that. But I mean, as you say, just as you mentioned, you know, the people who are involved in it, they can see whatever the Barack Obama goes on and says to Jay Leno, for God's sake, you know, on television.
Mm-hmm.
What happens in the street is what really happens, and so people are going to know that. Now, you know, the people who only know what's happening in the news media won't know it, but the actual people in the movement will know it.
Well, recently in a piece you wrote on your blog, Empire Burlesque, you called Greece the canary in the coal mine of hypercapitalism. Can you explain that, and then you kind of relate that to what's happening, you know, not just in the United States but around the world? How is the movement in Greece, how is it the same and how is it different from the movement here in the United States?
Well, that piece, yeah, that piece was based on a very good article that was in the Guardian over here by Kostas Douzinas, if I'm saying his name correctly. But it's, you know, it's just remarkable what has happened in Greece is that it's just a little bit further down the line of the Western nations where you have this elite, this rapacious elite that have simply gutted the country, and now in order to get out from under the responsibility for their own actions, they're simply devouring the state, they're devouring the poor people, they're devouring the middle class people and everything. And so and what they're also is leading in is, you know, they've completely shredded any sort of social net that they have there, all in order to the so-called austerity, in order to bail out the bankers who made these bad loans in the first place, knowing they were bad loans, and the people who took them out, the leaders who took them out, knew they were bad loans. And so it's just a... So what we're seeing in Greece is, I think, you know, it's like the beginning of what we can expect to keep going. And it won't happen in America in the same way because America and some of the developed countries, they're richer than Greece. I mean, Greece is, you know, sort of lives on the margins anyway. But just the attitudes that we see and what's coming, this kind of austerity and this sort of, and he talks about, too, abolition, this abolition of the right and the left division, you know, is now being, he says, you know, it's being replaced, and I think we see this in America, too, by a divide between, instead of, you know, there's a group of people on the right, there's a group of people on the left, and there's still a lot of that, but more and more there's the elite, and then there's everybody else, and this is one,
right.
This is one thing that Occupy is playing into. It's like, doesn't matter, right? There's somebody like, you know, you have Ron Paul who speaks up against the empire, but it's far to the right on other sort of things like that, but when you get to these sort of emergency situations, like we're in and been in the United States for a long time, and it gets worse and worse, then these things kind of go by the wayside and becomes the real divide becomes clear, I think. And I think that's what's happened in Greece. You have the unions together and, you have the bourgeoisie, the middle-class businessmen saying, you know, they're standing up for it too and against it too. So that's some of the thinking behind that.
Well, what do you think about this? A couple years ago, almost 3 years ago now, after Barack Obama was inaugurated and after my campaign against Nancy Pelosi in San Francisco, I wrote a book called Myth America, The 20 Greatest Myths of the Robber Class and the Case for Revolution. And I did make it a class divide. I said there's the robber class and there's the robbed class. And the robber class, you know, there's many people in the robber class that don't fit into the 1% income or wealth category. You know, they're the politicians, they're the corporate media, they're, you know, the members of the police state, you know, they're the military-industrial complex. So to say it's between the 1% and the 99%, I don't think tells the entire story.
No, it doesn't tell the whole I mean, yes, of course, any sort of elite is supported by, you know, usually a vast apparatus of sycophants and courtiers and, like you say, security. You know, I mean, it's a nice shorthand, though, to show where the political divides are coming. But yes, but of course, you're right. I mean, this is one of the main problems you have in America is where it's not so much in Greece, it's that the American, I don't even know what you want to call it now. Is it a military state? Is it a police state? Is it a security state? This whole apparatus is so huge.
Right,
you know,
you
know, I mean, of course, I'm not telling you anything, you know, but we're just talking, you know, this thing that came out in the Washington Post this last year about the national security state or whatever it is, something like 825,000 people with top security clearances. This is a kind of an armada of secret agents that are, you know, or people who are in the security apparatus that the KGB or the Stasi could not even dream of. You know, there's more people now in American security apparatus than was in the whole Communist Party back during Stalin's era, practically. You know, so it's like It's a vast thing. You're right. I mean, the 99% doesn't cover that. A lot of the 99, a number of the 99% are working, you know, but they're working for the 1%. So,
right.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that they say, and I've been at the Occupy movement close to me, and I was arrested, like, I don't know, 9 or 10 days ago there,
mm-hmm.
is they chant that the police, you know, they say the police are the 99%. The police are the 99%. Well, you know, that might be true in terms of income, but I haven't seen in my whole career of getting arrested like 15 or 16 times, I've never seen, you know, a member of the police, you know, protect me. They're always enforcing and protecting for the robber class. So, we have to, I think, restructure the dialogue a little bit.
Well, that has to be tempered with some more realism. I mean, I suppose what it is an aspiration. If you could somehow get the police to recognize that, you know, that you get. And I guess in some places you do. If not so much about the police, but you know, in Wisconsin, where you know, it's fine. Oh, if you start doing these public sector workers, and you start, you know, these maybe they'll wake up a little bit. But no, it's true. Of course. I mean, what are the police? The police are kind of a special case in that kind of sense, anyway. I mean, I don't know. I don't mean to make a sort of broad sweeping statement because I know, you know, but just in this day and age, what kind of mindset kind of goes into police in the first place, you know? But you're right.
Yeah.
These kind of people are very hard to reach, and they're not going to, and most of these people are not going to be reached, you know, with enlightened dialogue.
Chanting?
yeah.
With enlightened chanting?
yeah. So that's a difficult thing, you know. This is kind of the, when these sort of these institutions go on and they ossify and they become. No longer pretend to representing a broad spectrum of classes, politics, whatever you want to say, you know, when they become that hard, then it's sort of a self-perpetuating machine. It's almost like the American political system, the political parties. So many people keep looking to the politicians to be the hero, you know, Barack Obama's going to be the hero, somebody's going to be the hero, somebody's going to save us. Well, these people are in the political system, and with the political system now having gone on for so many generations and corrupt as it is, only a certain kind of person goes into the political system now. Only a certain kind of person rises to the top of the political system, and they're not the kind of person who's going to change things. Like you know, someone like we wouldn't be in Barack Obama's position unless you were prepared to do all these other sort of things. I mean, so these institutions sort of perpetuate a certain kind of person going into them, and this is a very hard nut to crack. I don't know how you crack this sort of thing, but. It makes it. We do need to have a more realistic appraisal of that. That's what's going on. You can't look to politicians. Who becomes a politician? And same way the mainstream media. You wouldn't become a very top name in the mainstream media unless you were a certain kind of person, and you already had a certain kind of beliefs. I mean, this is an old thing. I know you know it. Is that you know, they don't need to be censored because they already think that way,
right.
And they wouldn't be where
exactly.
they would. Yeah, unless they thought that way.
Yeah.
And the same way with the police to a large extent.
Well, let's shift gears a little bit. My whole involvement with the Occupy movement is trying to get them to think, you know, outside of their own little, you know, struggles. Because here in the United States, we usually don't protest or get out in the streets unless we have something personally at stake. And I can't judge people because. That was my case. I didn't start protesting until my son was killed, even though, you know, I felt the same way before he was killed as he was after he was killed. But the United States spends billions of dollars every month in, you know, the insane wars, the overt wars and the covert wars that we have going on. And since the Occupy movement has started, Barack Obama has assassinated many U.S. citizens and people who just happened to be, you know, near them at the time in Yemen with his what I call the presidential assassination program. And of course, he's complicit in the whatever happened to Gaddafi in Libya. And now we're being told, and we're supposed to believe, that the U.S. is ending the war in Iraq by the end of this year. Now, I know you have a lot of thoughts on that that are almost exactly identical to my thoughts. So what do you think about the U.S.? And what is the mood in Britain over this? Because, of course, Britain was our major partner in the destruction and the occupation of Iraq.
Well, so in Britain, I suppose, I mean, it's somewhat like it is in America, just all forgotten, you know. They don't want to think about it, and they feel like what you have over here is sort of like an attitude like, oh, that was mostly the Americans, you know. They kind of forget their continuing involvement in Iraq, the whole, you know, and their enabling of it, you know, because then it's a, well, Tony Blair's gone and all the people are gone, but, you know, so many people who were supported that are still in power, and they're still, and they haven't come to terms with it. That's one thing that I think is... has helped poison British politics over here, is that the Labour Party, which was the only sort of possible institutional venue, you know, to stand against anything, are completely complicit in all these war crimes, and they've never come to terms with it. They've never come to terms with it. They've never, how do you want to put it, they've never purged themselves. You know, they saw the same people who were involved in the government there. They have a couple of new leaders, but it doesn't matter. All these people were involved in the same government that perpetuated these crimes. And, of course, they're still involved in Afghanistan, heavily involved in Afghanistan. So, I mean, you have the same sort of myopic reaction, the same sort of amnesia over here, you know. It's like they just don't... and I find it's really remarkable because it's the same thing in America, but you'll sometimes see, even on the so-called left over here, you know, people in the Guardians and stuff, they will treat these British politicians as if they're dealing with ordinary politicians and not people who have either by direct hand or certainly with the support of the party, been deeply complicit in the murder, mass murder of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of innocent people. You know, things that make whatever they accuse Gaddafi of being look like a Sunday picnic or something like that. And yet, you know, you'll see over and over, just as America, we had to worry about their political fortunes and, oh, is labor at 31% or so-and-so, what's going to happen now? And they're like... I often think this in America, too. You read the paper, and sometimes if you read it, you get a little caught up just as you're watching it. It's sort of a sports reaction, you know, which team is ahead, which team is not ahead. Or, you know, you can read these sage analysis, well, you know, this move means Obama will be this, Obama will do that. But we're dealing with criminals. We're dealing with people who kill people. It's just, and there's no recognition of that in Britain, and there's no recognition of that in America either, as you know. So it's hard to even know where to begin, because if you're not dealing with the baseline reality of people involved in mass murder of the kind that we've, you know, supposedly condemned in America for 200 years, then what can you do? You know, it's like, and I'm sure you've learned this too. It's like you want to talk to someone, you want to try to convince someone differently, but you have to do such a massive re-education effort to even to get them to understand the first thing you're saying. You know, so, well, you know, because they're so marinated in myths and they're so stunned with amnesia that it's very hard. It's very difficult.
Well, and
you,
also,
I mean, you know more than anyone, so.
Right, and well, you know, Barack Obama had a big speech the other day saying that all the troops were coming home from Iraq, and that's not even, you know, that's just a lie. That doesn't have any basis in reality, does it?
No, it doesn't have any. I mean, it's not even... you're right. I mean, it's an overt lie. It's not even like some of them where they sort of, you know, shift around a little bit. It's like they're leaving thousands and thousands. I was writing with this the other day. You know, they admit that they're leaving thousands and thousands of armed men there just under the one thing of the State Department security forces. And they're also talking about, the trainers they're going to leave behind, the advisors they're going to leave behind, and negotiating. Do that. I mean, all this is open-ended. And it doesn't even begin to mention, I think Glenn Greenwald wrote about this the other day, all these special forces that we have operating in other countries anyway, you think they're not going to be operating in Iraq? So as I said the other day, at the very least, you'll have, you know, thousands and thousands and maybe tens of thousands of troops still in Iraq at the end of next year, armed men under U.S. control, whether they're wearing nice little uniforms and have Pizza Huts, you know, in their bases, or whether they're just walking the streets and killing people, or they're helping the Iraqi forces kill people. But, you know, I mean, it's just as plain as the sun rising and setting. It's just remarkable that not only can he say all that with a straight face, or maybe he went back and laughed about it afterwards. I don't know how straight his face was, but It's just, you know, again, you'll have people who accept it at face value. You'll have all these earnest debates and, you know, long columns and things. What does it mean by the blah, 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 blah? And it's not reality. It's like a hallucination or something.
Well, and it's so convenient for them to, when I say them, I mean the robber class, is that now that they have this lie about U.S. leaving Iraq, they can start to demonize Iran even more, saying, oh, we're going to leave this vacuum in Iraq, and then Iran's going to swoop in.
Well, yes, I mean, this is the next, you know, I mean, I've never been one to think. I mean, I could be wrong with this. I've never wanted to think that they're actually going to take an overt military action against Iran, because one thing it seems like to me has been proven over the years is that the war machine is, I don't know if it's manned by cowards, but it's certainly run by cowards, and they wouldn't do something. You know, they think they're going to get their hair messed up a little bit, but it doesn't matter. You know, as you know, as we've seen for the last years, and of course I could be wrong, because one can never ever underestimate their stupidity and their venality and their, their brutality. But, it doesn't matter. As long as you have that convenient stick to and that bloody shirt to wave around and scare people into doing this, that, and the other, then it serves its function already. So, but yes, I don't know what will happen with that. But certainly the same kind of drumbeat is being pounded again by the same people and the same lies, and it's really remarkable to see it happen over and over again, but I guess it's remarkable. It's quite gut-wrenchingly sad and heartbreaking, but it's also remarkable.
Well, it's just like what happened in Libya, and we only have a few more minutes left. When the UN approved a resolution for the no-fly zone in Libya, and the rhetoric I commented at the time, you know, it just seems like they didn't even bother to, disguise that they were just changing Saddam for Gaddafi, or Gaddafi for Saddam, and Libya for Iraq. It was the same exact kind of rhetoric. And I also made a comment when the UN resolution was first made that, you know, no-fly zone is just code word for, you know, bombing and killing civilians. And, of course, I was roundly criticized by the so-called liberals because they told me I didn't care about the people of Libya. And so what are your thoughts about what happened and what is happening in Libya?
Well, of course you didn't care about the people of Libya. You were just trying to stop them from being bombed to death, you know. I mean, what a callous and, you know, cruel person you are. I don't know. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, as you said, the thing about Libya was that it's not only were there the same old lies and the same old, scaremongering, it's that they didn't even try very hard. I thought, you know, they didn't even try very hard. It's like, oh, suddenly Libya's a threat to the world and, you know, there's a conflict in Libya and we have to go rescue these people. I mean, it was just also... It was also transparent that even some of the Republican warmongers, you know, couldn't quite get behind it. So, And what's happening now? I mean, as you say, what they've simply done is they've changed one regime, and now we've got a regime in there now. They just celebrated liberation, and one of the first acts that their new leader, who was himself a top Gaddafi henchman for many years, until just a few months ago, one of his first announcements is that, oh, we're going to look into loosening the laws on how many marriages a man can have. I mean, so this is what we've killed thousands of civilians for, is to institute, to sweep away another secular regime, just as we did in Iraq, and put people in power. Yeah, it's just, I don't know. As you said, I mean, almost, it's so transparent, it's so so bad, it's so... shoddily done, even, that it's hard to even comment on. I mean, it's just one more. And yet it's being counted. I see on the New York Times it's being counted some sort of another triumph for Obama's foreign policy. It's like, well, yes, if his foreign policy is to go around and murder thousands and thousands of people, which we know it is, it was a triumph. But as far as advancing the interests of the United States, as far as advancing the interest of peace in the Middle East, as far as advancing the interests of human beings to, you know, to be able to live and work out their own destiny and not be murdered from the air by bombs that they can't stop, then it wasn't a success. But again, this is not counted or thought about.
Well, you know, of course, we have, I believe we have an out-of-control empire in the United States, and besides Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan, we're in Libya, Uganda, Somalia, Yemen. Where do you think is next?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, there's so many balls in the air now. So, you know, I'm sure we can circle back around to South America at some point. You know, and there's, you know, there's more places in Africa to go to. Of course, there's always the big one now that people are thinking about, Pakistan. But you know, I don't know if you're going to pick a new fertile field. I mean, sooner or later, South America and Latin America in general will have to come back under the the whip hand at some point. So I don't know. It's a, you know, it's a fertile field for the war makers. They go anywhere they want, do whatever they want, and all they do is they don't even have to make up new lives. It, as you say, Saddam becomes Gaddafi, Gaddafi becomes Chavez, Chavez becomes Morales, Morales becomes, you know, anyone they want to make. You know,
yeah,
it becomes this, and they don't even try very hard. So, you know, it's an open field for them. Looks like to me.
Well, Chris, we're out of time. Can you tell my listeners where they can read your articles?
Well, yeah, I'm blogging at this blog called Empire Burlesque, and it's at www.chris-floyd.com, and that's where I am. When I can think of anything pertinent to say, that's where I say it.
Thank you so much for being on the show, Chris.
It was really wonderful to talk to you. All right.
Yes. Goodbye. Yes. Thank you. Our guest, Chris Floyd. I hope you enjoyed the very informative and enlightening interview. Well, that's it for the show today. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, my producer, Mikey, my guest, Chris Floyd, and you especially for listening and supporting this show. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and you've been listening at Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Thank you.
Make my witness. I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work. Scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest, I don't want you to riot, I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being, God damn it, my life has value.
get up now. I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Just get up from your chairs right now. Go stick your head out and yell and keep yelling, I'm as mad as hell, I'm not going to take this anymore! Just get up from your chairs.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.